Good evening. Mighty nice to be back. Feels good. It was a long time. Felt like. But it was a necessary trip and a successful trip, so I'm very happy about it. I saw my family in a little village in Texas, of all places that anybody would end up in. Hot and muggy. Sweet little village out in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by little oak trees. Hilly country like this, with little windy roads going through. And a 5-year-old granddaughter, so I got to color in the Hello Kitty coloring book, and string beads, and dress dollies in very beautiful sparkly clothes. I had a wonderful time. And then Sesshin in Boulder was very interesting. We had a shuso, a head practicer. He was ordained. This is Hakuzan, who was ordained last year and was asked to be the chief student. Carolyn did that job for us a couple of years ago, where the chief student does all the lowly jobs, gets to know everybody really, really well, has them over for tea, and helps out in every possible way. And then at the very end of the season of that, after a sesshin usually, sits with everyone and invites questions. And then the questions come one by one. You know, what is the essence of Buddhism? You know, how do you consider your practice? And since by then the students know him or her very well, it becomes a very intimate kind of challenge. And he did very well. There were a lot of people. The sesshin was very small, but about 25 people came and filled up the zendo. So he had a lot to... And his teacher made him do 9 bows to every ordained person in the group, and there were 10 of them. So he was streaming with perspiration by the time he was finished. But he kept his cool. He just did it. It's very impressive. Amazing what you can do when you have to. It's a very beautiful zendo. The temperature was 100 degrees outside, so it was really hot. But it was also a beautiful Japanese garden that you came out into with a winding pool, deep winding pool with blooming water lilies and fish sliding around underneath and showing up and jumping. And bullfrogs. So it was very colorful, very beautiful and very colorful sesshin. And lots of hard work, to which I want to encourage all of you. At dinner tonight, we went over the list of the sign-ups for sesshin, and it looks like we're going to have a very nice one in a few weeks, 3 weeks. We'll be sitting for a week. Yes?
That's too loud again.
Can't win. So I'm just here to encourage all of you to gird your loins and come to Carmel, because it's a extraordinary experience. can't be thought, can't be figured out, can't be analyzed. You just have to offer yourself to it and let yourself be surprised. So I didn't bring anything tonight because I didn't know what to bring. But I thought perhaps you all might have been talking about what to study. And I've been thinking about what to study as well. So I'd like to hear what your thinking has been on that. And I'll tell you what my thinking has been. So. Dan's the man.
Remind me, who's all there that's here tonight?
Wendy's not here tonight.
Ben? New guy Ben? Is that? Anyway, a small number of us got together. And I brought some books, and Wendy brought some books, and we chatted.
Mm-hmm.
And we chatted about possibly koans, possibly Bodhidharma, possibly Dogen, of course. And then the conversation shifted to a wonderful idea, which is what I bring forth. A number of people suggested studying people close to us in lineage. So they wanted to study Suzuki Roshi in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and Kogen Shima Roshi in Aspects of Sitting, which is that 25-page typed collection. These are both, people thought that it might be nice to do that from the point of view of not the old stuff again, but something more recent. And number two, maybe something again more introductory, something a little more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of our angle. We thought there's so many ways to study Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that we could figure that out when we got to it. But there are so many, you could do it as a chapter at a time, you could discussion, you could have lectures, you could cut it and dice it, slice it any which way, and it would still be wonderful, wonderful topics.
Yes.
So that's what we kind of thought about last time.
Okay. That does make sense. Yeah. What Martin has done, partly as part of the training of the Shuso in Boulder, was to lead them through all the major Mahayana material in a kind of overview, starting with the Prajnaparamita, the Heart Sutra, and then, I've forgotten how it goes, Shantideva, Nagarjuna, the Lotus Sutra, Bodhidharma, then the Chinese Huineng, the sixth patriarch, the third patriarch, and then the sixth. And then some koans from the old Chinese teachers, Dogen, and I think they stopped with Dogen. So it was over a whole year, and it wasn't very in-depth by any means, but it gave people an overview of, and he said you could see, as you studied from the very beginning parts of it, how it began to open up and flourish and become more and more profound as time went on. Up to Dogen. So that's another possibility. And in fact, we can do all of the above. There's absolutely no reason why we can't. We have infinite amount of time. So we can just proceed as we can. Anilin?
Did he talk about Leinen Sutra?
Oh, Vimalakirti is in there too. Yes, yes, yes. Yes, that's a wonderful one as well.
And Koban's teacher?
Chino Roshi?
Yeah. And was it homeless Kodo?
Oh, Kodo Tsuwaki. Yes, he was one of Koban's teachers. Oh, we should do Kodo.
Yeah. That was another idea, along with the idea of, close to him.
He's the closest.
Yeah,
he's closer than Suzuki Roshi.
Yeah,
Kodo Tsuwaki.
Direct.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just building up.
Yes. Yes. And then Uchiyama Roshi is his student, so,
yeah.
It opens up in that direction too. Oh, there's so many fine ways of expressing this totally impossible to express subject. It's too much. I was looking at all the material in my shelves, and I don't have very much really, but it's lots and lots and lots of it. Too much really. And yet we have to do this in some way. It's really important that we try to bring it up.
In the back of the book, The Eight Gates of Zen at Zen Monastery in New York, they have a study program that sounds the ambitious nature that you speak of. And they take they have like different like dimensions, and then so one dimension is history, one dimension is like the doctrine, one dimension is the practice.
Yes, yes.
And then they do it in successively more what you call it, demanding build. So it's like three aspects times, every level is more and more and more.
Yeah.
And I believe all the things you mentioned are in there plus.
I'm sure. Yeah.
It's a way of slicing and dicing the material.
Yes, San Francisco does that too. They have a curriculum.
Right.
And you're expected to know this, 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 and this. And, in our tradition, it hasn't been that way, and it's not going to be that way, at least while I'm around. But there's just to share what treasures there are, in a way that's accessible and has meaning for people. It's nothing that you have to memorize and then answer, exam questions about, or even represent as a Buddhist student. We're not representing the Dharma. We're just trying to live our life and live it well in a wholesome way. So whatever can help us, whatever insights and wisdoms can help us, that's the reason for a study. And then really, ideally, we forget it. Study it hard and then forget it. Well, maybe we could start with aspects of sitting. Since we're preparing for Sesshin, that would be very helpful anyway. It's about, mostly about how to sit, how to be this body. And I have more material, if I can find it. I have whole files of Koban's teachings. So I can try to dredge up more material to augment that too from him. So we could call that our preparation for Sesshin until... and then the talks during Sesshin will also be support and encouragement for that. Good, that's a very good idea. And then Suzuki Roshi afterward. That would be very nice too. It's still the most basic book. Now, if anybody wants to recommend a book about Zen, it's still the one. So I thought, since we don't have a book, now that we've decided, that I just open it up for questions and discussions about anything that's come up for us.
Get a chuckle around here whenever I think of some analogy. I always think of the highway, you know, always driving in the highway. Maybe it's because where we sit. What does it mean to practice? And I thought of an interesting analogy in the highway sense. It's kind of like when you come on the highway. If you come on the highway and you're going at 20 miles an hour and even in the right-hand lane you try to merge in, you're going to cause an accident because even the guy on the right-hand lane isn't going 20. And if you come on the highway and you're on the ramp and you're going 100, you're going to run into the guy on the right-hand lane on the highway because you're going too fast. So part of the driving is being aware enough of what's going on the highway to come in at the right speed.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean right and wrong. I mean appropriate. It's what is right now, and you are part of that. And if you don't, I'll use non-Zen terminology, if you're not sensitive to the condition, then you're going to not fit in. You're going to either cause an accident or someone's going to ram you.
Yeah.
And then the same thing is true when you get in the middle of the stream of cars. I've noticed this. Some days seem to be slowpoke days, and some days people are rocking. I mean, they're you know, 65. That's nobody's seen that number. They're going 80. And if you're going 65, you feel like you're going too slow. And there are other days that aren't like that. There are other days where 65 is too fast. And it's not even dependent on the weather. It's just something in the air or something. And I'm wondering if that's really what practice is all about. That it's not just the flow of the traffic. It's the flow of your life and everything around you and all the people and all the air and everything in between. And if you're just not aware of what that is, and there's that intuition about how things are, you're not going to get it. And then it's hard to be part of it. And yet, when you let it be and you're part of it naturally at the right pace, everything seems to be okay.
Mm-hmm. That's a good analogy. Yeah. And it has a lot to do with intention, you know, the intention to go a certain direction, for one thing, and to maintain parity with everything else. So, but even in an accident, you can't say that that is something that went wrong. It's just one more thing that happens. And the thing that causes it to be wrong is what you think about it. You can think it's wrong, and then it becomes a drama, and a personal drama. But if you consider it as part of the parity of everything, even though it's interrupted the flow, it's still a part of it. So one thing that we get stuck on is trying to make everything okay all the time, and it's not. But that not okayness is still okay, as long as we don't take it personally. For ourselves, it may not be so nice if it's our accident, you know. But even then, it's I have a friend who came down with cancer not long ago, and his attitude, he has a choice really of attitudes to take, and he can be pulling his hair and saying, oh, woe is me, and feeling like the universe has played him a dirty trick, you know, all the feelings that people can generate about it, and get very mad at his body. Like it's not his body anymore. But he isn't doing that. He's sees it as part of life, his life. It's not a personal thing. It's just the way life does itself. Sometimes it's, you know, you're a five-year-old child and you're blooming and growing, and then you get to be an older person and it begins to fall apart, and they call it cancer. And the falling apart is part of it as well. So it's what kind of reaction we have to what happens that creates the difficulty for us. But you're right, it's how we slip into the stream and how we maintain our equanimity in the stream, you know, and whatever happens. And that means not flipping the bird at somebody who passes at 85 miles an hour too, you know. Or we can, I mean, that's part of the play of it. But to understand, you know, what's happening. It is all a play. Which reminds me, Carolyn sends her very best. Her husband also has cancer. And I saw her today. She misses us very much and sends her love and says that they're doing better now because things are looking up a little bit. So I think we should all keep our fingers crossed for them. It's a long haul. It's not going to be over anytime soon. And I spoke with Ritu last night, and she's looking forward to coming to Sesshin. So she sends her best to everybody, too. I love that feeling of sun. Way out, way out.
Sangha, I've talked to Joyce, and she's given up driving. So
oh.
big step for her, and her grandson's coming to get her old Honda, like a 10-year-old Honda with 10,000 miles But so that's always kind of a big letting go. But she's very happy now that she's made the decision. Driving was just making her too anxious. The final deal was she drove to go visit a friend that was in the hospital just at Good Sam, which is not very far from where she lives. And by the time she got there, she walked in and they looked at her and they put her in the wheelchair and took her up to her friend's room. So after that, she decided she's had enough of driving.
Oh, dear. She's participating in Sesshin, though. She's offering a scholarship. So, as she did last year and the year before, I think, too. So, though she can't come and sit anymore, she's still right here, right with us. Jane?
Angie, do you think practice makes somebody joyous?
It certainly can. Yes. Yes, there's a deep joy, and a kind of poignant joy, you could say, often. The most famous joyful people practicers are the Tibetans.
I'm thinking of the Dalai Lama.
Yes, they're all like that. They'll burst into laughter at the drop of a hat, and they all have a laughter in their eyes. I think from such long practice that you just go in there, and what you find at the very end of all the effort is just joy is a good word for it, but a very lively and active and large joy, one that encompasses everyone. Now, it is, again, it's not a personal thing. It's just how things are. Kind of amazement. But there's lots of, you know, there's sadness in it. There's a deep poignance in it as well. Because life itself is poignant, and we're living beings, and as we honestly practice, we're letting go over and over. And that has a kind of regret as well as, you know, refreshing feeling. It's not so simple, our feelings in practice. And they change, of course. You know, when they describe the bhumis, joy is one of the first ones, and then it falls off at a certain point as you practice more. So that there's whole stages that supposedly we pass through as we sit, starting with a kind of feeling of felicity, happiness, not joy. And then the happiness transforms. I always forget the series, but joy is in one of the upper ones. And then even joy falls away, you know, with deeper insight. But I don't take any of that too seriously. I think it's better for us just to sit down and see what happens and not try to apply somebody else's ideas about it. Kai?
Study hard and then forget. Can you talk more about this? Yeah, I wanted to hear more about it. I guess probably I haven't studied. Now you're already talking about forget. So how do I know I have studied and when to forget? Or it's not a study first and then forget, it's
Well, I guess what I mean by study is sort of like getting in the pool of water and getting wet. And of course, Zazen itself is getting in the pool of water and getting wet. That's the experience. And then once we've had the experience of Zazen, it's helpful to study a bit. Other people's experience is confirmation of our own experience. That's really what it is. And bringing up into consciousness some things that otherwise are blurred or lost. So, but then once it's all present in our presence, it's not so important unless we have to talk to each other about it. And then it gives us the means of conversation. I didn't read very much until I had to do this job no. Skoban gave me the teaching stick, and I thought, my word, I don't know any words for this at all. I don't know how to say it. So then I began to read a lot. But it's all provisional. Words are just noise. And they're pointing somewhere. They're pointing to you and me, you know, the right here, right now part. So then, you know, we take it all with a grain of salt. You know, take the usefulness of it and let it go. Make room for the next. You know, otherwise, if we hold on to it, then there's not room for the next piece of information or insight or knowledge. Next week, is this true? I've asked Donna Lynn if she would give us a presentation of her work as her study, talking about study, really deep, hard study that she's done for a year on learning chaplaincy. She's been working with Gil Fronsdale and who's the Zen Center person who is? Paul Haller. And a great many other people. And I've asked her if she would share her experience with us and what she's learned. It's information that we all need. How to be with people in need, in crisis, and how to bring our practice fully into the presence of people who are helpless in some way. So Donna Lynn has had a lot of practice actually doing that, and now she's had a lot of book learning as well. So it should be very interesting. I hope you all can come. And in the meantime, I'll be getting Coben's material together, and the week after we'll start on that. And I'll see what I can come up with.